Wayne had seen elderly dogs with cleaner, healthier-looking teeth. Manx clutched a sheaf of papers in one hand, held together by a big yellow paperclip, and he sat in the driver's seat, thumbing through them in a cursory sort of way. The pages looked like they had already been handled some, and Manx considered them for only half a minute before leaning over and shutting them in the glove compartment.
"Bing has been busy on his computer," Manx said. "I remember an era when you could get your nose sliced off for sticking it too far into another man's business. Now you can find out anything about anyone with the click of a button. There is no privacy and no consideration, and everyone is prying into things that aren't their affair. You can probably check on the intertube and find out what color underwear I have on today. Still, the technology of this shameless new era does offer some conveniences. You would not believe all the information Bing has dug up on this Margaret Lee. I am sorry to say your mother's good friend is a drug addict and a woman of low character. I cannot say I am stunned. With your mother's tattoos and unfeminine mode of speech, that is exactly the crowd I would expect her to run with. You are welcome to read all about Miss Lee yourself if you like. I would not want you to be bored while we are on the road."
The drawer under the driver's seat slid open. The papers about Maggie Lee were in them. Wayne had seen this trick a few times now, and should have been used to it, but wasn't. He leaned forward and pulled out the sheaf of papers, and then the drawer banged shut, slamming closed so quickly and so loudly that Wayne cried out and dropped the whole mess on the floor. Charlie Manx laughed, the big, hoarse hee-haw of a country shithead who has just heard a joke involving a kike, a nigger, and a feminist.
"You did not lose a finger, did you? Nowadays cars come with all sorts of options nobody needs. They have radio beamed in from satellites, seat warmers, and GPS for people who are too busy to pay attention to where they are going, which is usually nowhere fast. But this Rolls has an accessory you will not find in many modern vehicles. A sense of humor. You'd better stay on your toes while you're in the race, Wayne. The old lady almost caught you napping."
And what a hoot that would have been. Wayne thought if he'd been a little slower, there was a good chance the drawer could have broken his fingers. He left the papers on the floor. Manx put his arm on the divider and turned his head to look through the rear window as he backed out of the garage. The scar across his forehead was livid and pink and looked 2 months old. He had removed the bandage from his ear. The ear was still gone, but the chewed ruin had healed over, leaving a ragged nub that was slightly more palatable to the eyes. Nosferatu rolled halfway down the driveway, and then Manx pulled to a stop. Bing Partridge, the gas mask man, was walking across the yard, holding a plaid-patterned suitcase in one hand. He had put on a stained, dirty FDNY baseball cap to go with a stained, dirty FDNY t-shirt and grotesquely girlish pink sunglasses.
"Ah," Manx murmured. "It would have been just as well if you had slept through this part of the day also. I am afraid the next few minutes may be disagreeable, young Master Wayne. It is never pleasant for a child when the grown-ups fight."
Bing walked in a swift-legged way to the trunk of the car, bent, and tried to open it. Except the trunk remained shut. Bing frowned, struggling with it. Manx was twisted around in his seat to watch him through the rear window. For all his talk about how things were soon to become disagreeable, there was the hint of a smile playing at the corners of his lips.
"Mr. Manx!" Bing called. "I can't get the trunk open!"
Manx didn't answer. Bing limped to the passenger side door, trying to keep his weight off the ankle that Hooper had gnawed on. His suitcase banged against his leg as he walked. As he put his hand on the latch for the passenger door, the lock banged down of its own accord. Bing frowned, tugged on the handle.
"Mr. Manx," he said.
"I can't help you, Bing," Manx said. "The car doesn't want you."
The wraith began to roll backward. Bing wouldn't let go of the handle and was pulled alongside. He jerked at the latch again. His jowls wobbled.
"Mr. Manx, don't go! Mr. Manx, wait for me! You said I could come!"
"That was before you let her get away, Bing. You let us down. I might forgive you. You know I have always thought of you as a son. But I have no say in this. You let her get away, and now the Wraith is letting you get away. The Wraith is like a woman, you know. You cannot argue with a woman. They are not like men. They do not operate by reason. I can feel that she is spitting mad at you for being so careless with your gun.
No, Mr. Mangs, give me another chance, please. I want another chance.
He stumbled and banged his suitcase against his leg once again. It spilled open, dumping undershirts and underwear and socks down the length of the driveway.
Bing, Mang said. Bing, bing. Go away. I'll come and play some other day.
I can do better. I'll do whatever you want. Please, oh please, Mr. Mang. I want a second chance.
Screaming now.
Don't we all, Mang said. But the only person who has been granted a second chance is Victoria McQueen, and that's just no good, Bing.
As the car backed up, it began to swing around to face the road. Bing was pulled right off his feet and collapsed on the blacktop. The Wraith dragged him for several feet, squalling and yanking at the handle.
Anything, anything, Mr. Manx, anything for you, my life for you.
My poor boy, Mank said. My poor, sweet boy. Do not make me sad. You are making me feel awful. Let go of the door, please. This is hard enough.
Bing let go, although Wayne could not say if he was doing as he was told or if his strength simply gave out. He flopped in the road, on his stomach, sobbing. The Wraith began to accelerate away from Bing's house, away from the burned wreck of the church up the hill. Bing scrambled back to his feet and jogged after them for perhaps 10 yards, although he was quickly outdistanced. Then he stopped in the middle of the road and began to beat his head with his fists, punching himself in the ears. His pink sunglasses hung askew, one lens smashed in. His wide, ugly face was a bright, poisonous shade of red.
I would do anything, Bing screamed, anything, just give me one more chance.
The Wraith paused at a stop sign, then turned the corner, and Bing was gone. Wayne turned to face forward. Manx glanced at him in the rearview mirror.
I'm sorry you had to see all of that, Wayne, Manx said. Terrible to see someone so upset, especially a good-hearted fellow like Bing. Just terrible. But also a bit silly, don't you think? Did you see how he wouldn't let go of the door? I thought we were going to drag him all the way to Colorado.
Manx laughed again, quite heartily. Wayne touched his lips and realized, with a sick pang in his stomach, that he was smiling.
Route 3, New Hampshire. The road had a clean smell of evergreens, of water, of woods. Vic thought there would be sirens, but when she looked in the left-hand mirror, she saw only a half mile of empty asphalt, and there was no sound at all but the controlled roar of the Triumph. A passenger jet slid through the sky 24,000 feet above her, a brilliant spoke of light headed west. At the next turn, she left the lake road and swung into the green hills mounded over Winnipesaukee, headed west herself. She didn't know how to get to the next part, didn't know how to make it work, and thought she had very little time to figure it out. She had found her way to the bridge the day before, but that seemed a fantastically long time ago, almost as long ago as childhood. Now it seemed too sunny and bright for something impossible to happen. The clarity of the day insisted on a world that made sense, that operated by known laws. Around every bend there was only more road, the blacktop looking fresh and rich in the sunshine. Vic followed the switchbacks, climbing steadily into the hills, away from the lake. Her hands were slippery on the handlebars, and her foot hurt from pushing the sticky shift through the gears. She went faster, and then faster still, as if she could tear that hole in the world by speed alone. She blew through a town that was little more than a yellow caution sign hanging over a four-way intersection. Vic meant to run the bike until it was out of gas, and then she might drop it, leave the Triumph in the dust, and start running, right down the center of the road, running until the fucking shorter way bridge appeared for her or her legs gave out. Only it wasn't going to appear, because there was no bridge. The only place the shorter way existed was in her mind. With every mile, this fact became clearer to her. It was what her psychiatrist had always insisted it was, an escape hatch she leaped through when she couldn't handle reality, the comforting empowerment fantasy of a violently depressed woman with a history of trauma. She went faster, taking the curves at almost 60. She was going so fast it was possible to pretend the water streaming from her eyes was a reaction to the wind blowing in her face. The Triumph began to climb again, hugging the inside of a hill. On a curve near the crest, a police cruiser blasted past, going the other way. She was close to the double line and felt the slipstream snatch at her, giving her a brief, dangerous moment of wobble. For an instant, the driver was just an arm's length away. His window was down, his elbow hanging out, a dude with two chins and a toothpick in the corner of his mouth. She was so close she could have snatched the toothpick from between his lips. In the next moment, he was gone and she was over the hill. He had probably been gunning it for that four-way intersection with the yellow caution light, looking to cut her off there. He would have to follow the winding road he was on all the way into town before he could turn and come back after her. She had maybe a full minute on him. The bike swung through a high, tight curve, and she had a glimpse of Paugus Bay below, dark blue and cold. She wondered where she would be locked up, when she would next see the water. She had spent so much of her adult life in institutions, eating institutional food, living by institutional rules. Lights out at 8:30, pills in a paper cup, water that tasted like rust, like old pipes, stainless steel toilet seats, and the only time you saw blue water was when you flushed. The road rose and dropped in a little dip, and in the hollow there was a country store on the left. It was a two-story place made out of peeled logs, with a white plastic sign over the door that said, North Country Video. Store still rented videos out here. Not just DVDs, but videotapes, too. Vic was almost past the place when she decided to swing into the dirt lot and hide. The parking area extended around back, and it was dark there beneath the pines. She stood on the rear brake, already going into her turn, when she remembered there was no rear brake. She grabbed the front brake. For the first time, it occurred to her that it might not be working either. It was. The front brake grabbed hard, and she almost went over the handlebars. The rear tire whined shrilly across the blacktop, painting a black rubber streak. She was still sliding when she hit the dirt lot. The tires tore at the earth, raised clouds of brown smoke. The Triumph jackhammered another 12 feet, past North Country Video, crunching to a stop at last in the back of the lot. A nighttime darkness waited beneath the evergreens. Behind the building, a loop of sagging chain barred access to a footpath, a dusty trench carved through weeds and ferns. A dirt bike run, maybe, or out-of-use hiking trail. She had not spied it from the road. No one would, set back as it was in the shadows. She didn't hear the cop car until it was very close, her ears full of the sound of her own ragged breath and overworked heart. The cruiser shrieked past, the undercarriage crashing as it skipped over the frost heaves. She saw a flicker of movement at the edge of her vision. She looked up at a plate glass window, half pasted over with posters advertising the Powerball. A fat girl with a nose ring was staring out at her, her eyes wide with alarm. She had a phone to her ear, and her mouth was opening and closing. Vic looked at the footpath on the other side of that chain. The narrow rut was drifted with pine needles. It pointed steeply downhill. She tried to think what was down there. Route 11, most likely. If the path didn't lead to the highway, she could at least follow it until it petered out, then park the bike in the pines. It would be peaceful among the trees, a good place to sit and wait for the police. She shifted into neutral and walked it around the chain. Then she put her feet on the pegs and let gravity do the rest. Vic rode through a felty darkness that smelled sweetly of furs, of Christmas, a thought that made her shiver. It reminded her of Haverhill, of the town woods, and of the slope behind the house where she had grown up. The tires bumped over roots and rocks, and the bike shimmied across the uncertain ground. It took great concentration to guide the motorcycle along the narrow rut. She stood on the pegs to watch the front tire. She had to stop thinking, had to go empty, couldn't spare any room inside her head for the police or Lou or Manx or even Wayne. She could not try to work things out now. She had to focus instead on staying balanced. It was, anyway, difficult to remain frantic in the piney gloom, with the light slanting down through the boughs and an atlas of white cloud inscribed on the sky above. The small of her back was stiff and tight, but the pain was sweet, made her aware of her own body working in concert with the bike. A wind rushed in the tops of the pines with a gentle roar, like a river in flood. She wished she had had a chance to take Wayne on the motorcycle. If she'd been able to show him this, these woods, with their sprawling carpet of rusty pine needles, beneath the sky lit up with the first best light of July, she thought it would have been a memory for both of them to hold on to for the rest of their lives. What a thing it would be to ride through the scented shadows with Wayne clutching her tight, to follow a dirt path until they found a peaceful place to stop, to share out a homemade lunch and some bottles of soda, to doze off together by the bike in this ancient house of sleep, with its floor of mossy earth and its high ceiling of crisscrossing boughs. When she closed her eyes, she could almost feel Wayne's arms around her waist. But she only dared close her eyes a moment. She breathed out and looked up, and in that moment the motorcycle arrived at the bottom of the slope and crossed 20 feet of flat ground to the covered bridge. Shorter Way. Vic tapped the rear brake with her foot, an automatic gesture that did nothing. The motorcycle kept on, rolling almost to the entrance of the Shorter Way bridge before she remembered the front brake and eased herself to a stop. It was ridiculous, a 300-foot-long covered bridge sitting right on the ground in the middle of the woods, bridging nothing. Beyond the ivy-tangled entrance was an appalling darkness.
"Yeah," Vic said. "Okay, you're pretty Freudian."
Except it wasn't. It wasn't Mommy's coochie. It wasn't the birth canal. The bike wasn't her symbolic cock or a metaphor for the sexual act. It was a bridge spanning the distance between lost and found. A bridge over what was possible. Something made a fluttering sound in among the rafters. Vic inhaled deeply and smelled bats, a musty animal smell, wild and pungent. All those times she had crossed the bridge, not once had it been the fantasy of an emotionally disturbed woman. That was a confusion of cause and effect. She had been, at moments in her life, an emotionally disturbed woman because of all those times she had crossed the bridge. The bridge was not a symbol, maybe, but it was an expression of thought, her thoughts, and all the times she had crossed it had stirred up the life within. Floorboards had snapped, litter had been disturbed. Bats had woken and flown wildly about. Just inside the entrance, written in green spray paint, were the words, "The House of Sleep." She put the bike into first and bumped the front tire up onto the bridge. She did not ask herself if the shorter way was really there, did not wonder if she was easing into a delusion. The issue was settled. Here it was. The ceiling above was carpeted in bats, their wings closed around them to hide their faces, those faces that were her own face. They squirmed restlessly. The boards went kabang, bang, bang under the tires of the bike. They were loose and irregular, missing in places. The whole structure shook from the force and weight of the bike. Dust fell from the beams above in a trickling rain. The bridge had not been in such disrepair when she last rode through. Now it was crooked, the walls visibly tilting to the right like a corridor in a funhouse. She passed a gap in the wall where a board was missing. A flurry of luminous particles snowed past the narrow slot. Vic eased almost to a stop, wanting a closer look. But then a board under the front tire cracked with a sound as loud as a gun firing, and she felt the wheel drop 2 inches. She grabbed the throttle and the bike jumped forward. She heard another board snap under the back tire as she lunged ahead. The weight of the bike was almost too much for the old wood. If she stopped, the rotted boards might give way beneath her and drop her into whatever that was. The chasm between thought and reality, between imagining and having, perhaps. She couldn't see what the tunnel opened onto. Beyond the exit, she saw only glare, a brightness that hurt her eyes. She turned her face away and spied her old blue and yellow bicycle, its handlebars and spokes hung with cobwebs. It was dumped against the wall. The front tire of her motorcycle thumped over the wooden lip and dropped her out onto asphalt. Fick glided to a stop and put her foot down. She shaded her eyes with one hand and peered about. She had arrived at a ruin. She was behind a church that had been destroyed by fire. Only its front face remained, giving it the look of a movie set, a single wall falsely suggesting a whole building behind it. There were a few blackened pews and a field of smoked and shattered glass, strewn with rusting beer cans. Nothing beside remained. A sun-faded parking lot, boundless and bare, stretched away, lone and level, as far as she could see. She banged the Triumph into first and took a ride around to the front of what she assumed was the House of Sleep. There she halted once more, the engine rumbling erratically, hitching now and then. There was a sign out front, the sort with letters on clear plastic cards that could be shifted around to spell different messages. It seemed more like the kind of sign that belonged in front of a Dairy Queen than in front of a church. Vic read what was written there, and her body crawled with chill. The New American. Faith Tabernacle. God burned alive. Only devils now. Beyond was a suburban street, slumbering in the stuporous heat of late day. She wondered where she was. It might still be New Hampshire, but no, the light was wrong for New Hampshire. It had been clear and blue and bright there. It was hotter here, with oppressive clouds mounded in the sky, dimming the day. It felt like thunderstorm weather, and in fact, as she stood there straddling the bike, she heard the first rumbling detonation of thunder in the distance. She thought that in another minute or two it might begin to pour. She scanned the church again. There were a pair of angled doors set against the concrete foundation, basement doors. They were locked with a heavy chain and a bright brass lock. Beyond, set back in the trees, was a sort of shed or barn, white with a blue shingled roof. The shingles were fuzzed with moss, and there were even some weeds and dandelions growing right from the roof. There was a large barn door at the front, big enough to admit a car, and a side door with just one window. A sheet of paper was taped up inside the glass. There, she thought, and when she swallowed, her throat clicked. He's in there. It was Colorado all over again. The Wraith was parked inside the shed, and Wayne and Manx were sitting in it, waiting out the day. The wind lifted, hot, roaring in the leaves. There was another sound as well, somewhere behind Vic, a kind of frantic mechanical whirring, a steely rustle. She looked down the road. The closest house was a well-kept little ranch, painted strawberry pink with white trim, so it resembled a Hostess snack cake, the ones with coconut on them. Snowballs, Vic thought they were called. The lawn was filled with those spinning tinfoil flowers that people stuck in their yards to catch the wind. They were going crazy now. A stubby, ugly retiree was out in his driveway, holding a pair of garden shears, squinting up at her. Probably a neighborhood watch type, which meant if she wasn't dealing with a thunderstorm in 5 minutes, she would be dealing with the cops. She rode the bike to the edge of the lot, then switched it off, left the keys in it. She wanted to be ready to go in a hurry. She looked again at the shed, standing to one side of the ruin. She noticed, almost as an afterthought, that she had no spit. Her mouth was as dry as the leaves rustling in the wind. She felt pressure building behind her left eye, a sensation she remembered from childhood. Vic left the bike, began walking toward the shed on her suddenly unsteady legs. Halfway there, she bent and picked up a broken chunk of asphalt, the size of a dinner plate. The air vibrated with another distant concussive roll of thunder. She knew it would be a mistake to call her son's name, but found her lips shaping the word anyway. Wayne. Wayne. Her pulse hammered behind her eyeball, so the world seemed to twitch unsteadily around her. The overheated wind smelled of steel shavings. When she was within 5 steps of the side door, she could read the hand-lettered sign taped up on the inside of the glass. No admittance. Town personnel only. The chunk of asphalt went through the window with a pretty smash, tore the sign free. Vic wasn't thinking anymore, just moving. She had lived this scene already and knew how it went. She might have to carry Wayne if there was something wrong with him, as there had been something wrong with Brad McCauley. If he was like McCauley, half-ghoul, some kind of frozen vampire, she would fix him. She would get him the best doctors. She would fix him like she had fixed the bike. She had made him in her body. Manx could not simply unmake him with his car. She shoved her hand through the shattered window to grab the inner doorknob. She fumbled for the bolt, even though she could see that the Wraith wasn't in there. There was room for a car, but no car was present. Bags of fertilizer were stacked against the walls.
"Hey, what are you doing?" called a thin, piping voice from somewhere behind her. "I can call the cops. I can call them right now."
Vic turned the bolt, threw the door open, stood gasping, looking into the small, cool, dark space of the empty shed.
"I should have called the police already. I can have the whole bunch of you arrested for breaking and entering," screamed whoever it was.
She was hardly listening, but even as she had been paying close attention, she might not have recognized his voice. It was hoarse and strained, as if he had recently been crying or was about to start. There on the hill, it did not once cross her mind that she had heard it before. She turned on her heel, taking in a squat, ugly man in an FDNY t-shirt, the retiree who had been out in his yard with hedge clippers. He still held them. His eyes bulged behind glasses with thick black plastic frames. His hair was short and bristly and patchy, black mottled with silver. Vic ignored him. She scanned the ground, found a chunk of blue rock, grabbed it, and stalked across to the slanted doors that led to the basement of the burned church. She dropped to one knee and began to strike at the big brassy Yale lock that kept those doors shut. If Wayne and Manx weren't in the shed, then this was the only place that was left. She didn't know where Manx had stashed the car, and if she found him asleep down there, she had no plans to ask him about it before using this stone on his head. "Come on," she said to herself. "Come on and open the fuck up." She banged the stone down into the lock. Sparks flew.
"That's private property," cried the ugly man. "You and your friends have no right to go in there. That's it. I'm calling the police."
It caught her notice then, what he was yelping. Not the part about the police, the other part. She threw the stone aside, swiped at the sweat on her face, and shoved herself to her heels. When she rounded on him, he took two frightened steps back and nearly tripped over his own feet. He held the garden shears up between them.
Don't hurt me!
Vic supposed she looked like a criminal and a lunatic. If that was what he saw, she couldn't blame him. She had been both at different times in her life. She held her hands out, patting the air in a calming gesture. "I'm not going to hurt you. I don't want anything from you. I'm just looking for someone. I thought there might be someone in there," she said, gesturing with her head back toward the cellar doors. "What did you say about my friends? What friends?" The ugly little gnome swallowed thickly.
"They aren't here, the people you're looking for. They left, drove away a little while ago, a half an hour or so, maybe less."
"Who? Please help me. Who left? Was it someone in..."
"An old car," the little man said. "Like an antique. He had it parked there in the shed. And I think he spent the night in there," pointing at the slanted basement doors. "I thought about calling the police. It isn't the first time there's been people in there doing drugs, but they're gone. They aren't here anymore. He drove away a while ago. A half an hour."
"You said that," she told him. She wanted to grab him by his fat neck and shake him. "Was there a boy with him? A boy in the back of the car?"
"Why, I don't know," the man said and put his fingers to his lips and stared into the sky, an almost comic look of wonder on his face. "I thought there was someone with him in the back. Yes, yes, I bet there was a kid in the car."
He glanced at her again.
"Are you all right? You look awful. Do you want to use my phone? You should have something to drink."
"No, yes, I... thank you. All right." She swayed as if she had stood up too quickly. He had been here. Wayne had been here and gone. Half an hour ago. Her bridge had steered her wrong. Her bridge, which always led her across the distance between lost and found, had not set her down in the right place at all. Maybe this was the house of sleep,
this derelict church, this litter of charred beams and broken glass, and she had wanted to find this place, had wanted it with all her heart, but only because Wayne was supposed to be here. Wayne was supposed to be here, not out on the road with Charlie Manx. That was it, she supposed, in a weary sort of way. Just as Maggie Lee's Scrabble tiles could not give proper names, Vic remembered that now, was remembering a lot this morning. Vic's bridge needed to anchor either end on solid earth. If Manx was on an interstate somewhere, her bridge couldn't connect. It would be like trying to poke a bullet out of the air with a stick. Vic flashed to a memory of a lead slug tunneling through the lake, remembered slapping at it, then finding it in her hand. The shorter way didn't know how to carry her to something that wouldn't stand still, so it had done the next best thing. Instead of leading her to where Wayne was, it had brought her to where Wayne had last been. Lurid red flowers grew along the foundation of the strawberry pink house. It was set up the street and away from other houses, a place nearly as lonely as a witch's cottage in a fairy tale, and in its own way as fantastical as a house made of gingerbread. The grass was neatly kept. The ugly little man led her around back to a screen door that opened into a kitchen. "I wish I could have a second chance," he said. "At what?" He seemed to need a moment to think about it. "A chance to do things over. I could have stopped them from going, the man and your son." "How could you have known?" she asked. He shrugged. "Did you come a long way?" he asked in his thin, off-key voice. "Yes, sort of," she said. "Not really." "Oh, I see now," he said, without the slightest trace of sarcasm. He held the door open for her, and she preceded him into the kitchen. The air conditioning was a relief, almost as good as a glass of cold water with a sprig of mint in it. It was a kitchen for an old woman who knew how to make homemade biscuits and gingerbread men. The house even smelled a little like gingerbread men. The walls were hung with cutesy kitchen plaques, rhyming ones. "I pray to God on my knees. Don't let Mommy feed me peas." Vic saw a battered green metal tank propped in a chair. It reminded her of the oxygen tanks that had been delivered weekly to her mother's house in the last few months of Linda's life. She assumed that the man had a wife somewhere who was unwell. "My phone is your phone," he said in his loud, off-key voice. Thunder cannonaded outside, hard enough to shake the floor. She passed the kitchen table on her way to an old black phone, bolted to the wall next to the open basement door. Her gaze shifted. There was a suitcase on the table, unzipped to show a mad tangle of underwear and T-shirts, also a winter hat and mittens. Mail had been pushed off the table onto the floor, but she didn't see it until it was crunching underfoot. She stepped quickly off of it. "Sorry," she said. "Don't worry," he said. "It's my mess and I'll clean it up." He bent and scooped up the envelopes in his big, knuckly hands. "Bing, bing, you ding-a-ling, you made a mess of everything." It was a bad little song, and she wished he hadn't sung it. It seemed like something someone would do in a dream beginning to go rotten around the edges. She turned to the phone, a big, bulky thing with a rotary dial. Vic meant to pick up the receiver, but then rested her head against the wall and shut her eyes instead. She was so tired, and her left eye hurt so fucking much. Besides, now that she was here, she didn't know who to call. She wanted Tabitha Hutter to know about the church at the top of the hill, the torched house of God. God burned alive, only devils now, where Manx and her son had spent the night. She wanted Tabitha Hutter to come here and talk to the old man who had seen them, the old man named Bing. Bing? But she didn't even know where here was yet, and wasn't sure it was in her interest to call the police until she did. Bing. The name disconcerted her in some way. "What did you say your name is?" she asked, wondering if she could have heard him wrong. "Bing." "Like the search engine?" she asked. "That's right, but I use Google." She laughed, a sound that expressed exhaustion more than humor, and cast a sidelong glance toward him. He had turned his back to her, was tugging something off a hook next to the door. It looked like a shapeless black hat. She had another glance at that old, dented green tank, and saw that it wasn't oxygen after all.
The stenciling on the side said sevoflurane, flammable. She turned away from him, back to the phone. She lifted the receiver, but still didn't know who she wanted to call.
That's funny, she said. I have a search engine of my own. Can I ask you a weird question, Bing?
Sure, he said.
She glided her finger around the rotary dial without turning it.
Bing. Bing. Less like a name, more like the sound a little silver hammer would make hitting a glass bell.
I'm a bit overtaxed, and the name of this town is slipping my mind, she said. Can you tell me where the hell I am?
Manx had a silver hammer, and the man with him had a gun.
Bang, he'd said. Bang, right before he shot her. Only he said it in a funny, sing-songy way, so it was less like a threat, more like a jump rope rhyme.
You bet,
Bing said from behind her, his voice muffled, as if he had a hanky over his nose. She recognized his voice then. It had been muffled the last time she'd heard it, and her ears had been ringing from gunfire, but she recognized his voice at last. Vic pivoted on her heel, already knowing what she would see. Bing wore his old-fashioned World War II gas mask again. He still held the garden shears in his right hand.
You're in the House of Sleep, he said. This is the end of the line for you, bitch.
And he hit her in the face with the garden shears and broke her nose.
The House of Sleep.
Vic took three small, staggering steps backward, and her heel struck a door sill. The only open door was the one into the basement. She had time to recall this before the next thing happened. Her legs gave way, and she fell straight back, as if to sit down, but there was no chair there. There was no floor, either. She dropped and kept dropping. This is going to hurt, she thought. There was no alarm in the idea. It was the simple acceptance of fact. She experienced a brief feeling of suspension, her insides going elastic and strange. The wind swished past her ears. She glimpsed a bare light bulb overhead and plywood sheeting between exposed beams. Vic hit a stair, ass first, with a bony crunch, and was flipped as casually as someone might toss a pillow in the air. She thought of her father pitching a cigarette out the window of a moving car, the way it would hit the asphalt and sparks would fly on impact. The next step she hit on her right shoulder, and she was thrown again. Her left knee clubbed something. Her left cheek struck something else. It felt like getting booted in the face. Vic assumed when she hit bottom that she would smash like a vase. Instead, she landed on a lumpy mound of plastic-wrapped softness. She slammed into it face first, but the lower part of her body continued traveling, her feet pedaling madly in the air.
"Look, Mom, I'm doing a handstand!"
Vic remembered screaming one 4th of July, staring at a world where the sky had become grass and the ground had become stars. She thudded to a stop at last, lying on her back on the plastic-wrapped mass, the staircase now behind her. Vic stared back up the steep flight of steps, seeing them upside down. She could not feel her right arm. There was a pressure in her left knee that she believed would soon turn to excruciating pain. The gas mask man came down the steps, holding the green metal tank in one hand, carrying it by the valve. He had left the pruning shears behind. It was terrible, the way the gas mask took his face away, replacing his mouth with a grotesque alien knob, and his eyes with clear plastic windows. A part of her wanted to scream, but she was too stunned to make any noise. He came off the bottom step and stood with her head between his boots. It occurred to her too late that he was going to hurt her again. He lifted the tank in both hands and brought it down into her stomach, pounded the air out of her. Vic coughed explosively and rolled onto her side. When she got her breath back, she thought she would throw up. The tank clanged as he set it down. The gas mask man collected a handful of her hair and yanked. The tearing pain forced a weak cry out of her, in spite of her decision to remain silent. He wanted her on all fours, and she obliged him because it was the only way to make the pain stop. His free hand slipped under her and groped her breast, squeezing it the way someone might test a grapefruit for firmness. He tittered. Then he dragged. She crawled while she could because it hurt less, but it didn't matter to him whether it hurt or not.
and when her arms gave out, he kept dragging, pulling her along by the hair. She was horrified to hear herself scream the word, "Please!" Vic had only confused impressions of the basement, which seemed less a room than a single long corridor. She glimpsed a washer and dryer, a naked female mannequin wearing a gas mask, a grinning bust of Jesus pulling his robe open to show an anatomically correct heart, the side of his face browned and blistered as if he had been held in a fire. She heard a metallic droning chime coming from somewhere. It went on and on without cessation. The gas mask man stopped at the end of the hall, and she heard a steely clunk, and he slid aside a heavy iron door on a track. Her perceptions couldn't keep up with the pace of events. A part of her was still back down the hallway, just catching a glimpse of that burned Jesus. Another part of her was in the kitchen, seeing the battered green tank leaning in the chair, sevoflurane, flammable. A part of her was up at the torched wreckage of the New American Faith Tabernacle, holding a rock in both hands and banging it down into a shiny brass lock, hard enough to throw copper sparks. A part of her was in New Hampshire, bumming a smoke off Detective Daltrey, palming his brass lighter, the one with Popeye on it. The gas mask man forced her to walk on her knees across the track, still yanking her by the hair. In his other hand, he dragged the green tank, sevoflurane. That was what was making the chiming sound. The base of the tank rang softly and continuously as it was pulled across the concrete. It droned like a Tibetan prayer bowl, a monk rolling the hammer around and around the holy dish. When she was over the track, he jerked her forward hard, and she found herself on all fours once again. He planted his foot in her ass and shoved, and her arms gave out. She went down on her chin, her teeth banged together, and a blackness leaped up from every object in the room, the lamp in the corner, the cot, the sink, as if each piece of furniture had a secret shadow self that could be jolted awake, startled into flight like a flock of sparrows. For a moment that flock of shadows threatened to descend upon her. She chased it back with a cry. The room smelled like old pipes, concrete, unwashed linens, and rape. Vic wanted to get up, but it was hard enough remaining conscious. She could feel that trembling, living darkness ready to come uncoiled and spring up all around her. If she passed out now, she would at least not feel him raping her. She would not feel him killing her, either. The door rattled and banged shut with a silvery clash that reverberated in the air. The gas mask man gripped her shoulder, pushed her onto her back. Her head rolled loosely on her neck and her skull wrapped the pitted concrete. He knelt over her with a clear plastic mask in one hand, contoured to fit over her mouth and nose. The gas mask man took her by the hair and pulled her head up to snap the mask over her face. Then he put his hand on it and held it there. Clear plastic tubing ran back to the tank. She swatted at the hand, clamping the mask to her face, tried to scratch his wrist, but he now wore a pair of heavy canvas gardening gloves. She couldn't get at any vulnerable meat. "Breathe deep," he said. "You'll feel better. Just relax. Day is done, gone the sun. God burned to death, and I shot him with my gun." He kept the one hand over the mask. With the other, he reached back and twisted a valve on the tank. She heard a hiss and felt something cool blowing against her mouth, then gasped at a saccharine blast of something that smelled like gingerbread. She grabbed at the tubing and wound it around one hand and yanked. It came out of the valve with a tinny pop. The tank hissed a visible stream of white vapor. The gas mask man glanced back at the green metal tank but did not seem perturbed. "About half of them does that," he said. "I don't like it because it wastes the tank, but if you want to do things hard, we can do them hard." He ripped the plastic mask off her face, tossed it into the corner. She started to push her way up onto her elbows, and he drove his fist into her stomach. She doubled over, wrapping her arms around the hurt, holding it tightly, like a loved one. She took a big whooping breath, and the room was filled with the woozy-making fragrance of gingerbread-scented gas. The gas mask man was short, half a foot shorter than Vic, and dumpy, but despite that he moved with the agility of a street performer, a guy who could play the banjo while strolling around on stilts. He picked up the tank in both hands and walked it toward her, pointing the open valve at her.
The gas was a white spray as it came from the end of the valve, but soon dispersed, became invisible. She gulped another mouthful of air that tasted like dessert. Vic Crabb walked backward, pushing herself across the floor on hands and feet, sliding on her butt. She wanted to hold her breath but couldn't do it. Her trembling muscles were starved for oxygen.
"Where are you going?" he asked through his gas mask.
He walked after her with the tank.
"It's airtight in here. Anywhere you go, you still gotta breathe. I got 300 liters in this tank. I could knock out a tent full of elephants with 300 liters, honey."
He kicked one of her feet, knocking her legs askew, then pushed the toe of his left sneaker into her crotch. She choked on a cry of revulsion. Vic had a fleeting but intense sensation of violation. For one moment she wished the gas had already put her out. Didn't want to feel his foot there. Didn't want to know what was going to happen next.
"Bitch, bitch, go to sleep," the gas mask man said. "Take a nap while I fuck you deep."
He tittered again. Vic pushed herself back into a corner, thumped her head on the plastered wall.
He was still walking at her, holding the tank, fogging the room.
The sevoflurane was a white mist that made every object soft and diffuse at the edges. There had been one cot on the other side of the room, but now there were three, tightly overlapping one another, and they were half hidden behind the smoke. In the gathering haze, the gas mask man himself split in two, then came back together. The floor was slowly tipping beneath her, turning into a slide, and at any moment she'd go whisking down it, away from reality and into unconsciousness. She kicked her heels, fighting to hold on, to hold fast in the corner of the room. Vic held her breath, but her lungs were filled not with air, but with pain, and her heart was slamming like the engine of a Triumph.
"You're here, and it's all better," the gas mask man shrieked, his voice delirious with excitement. "You're my second chance. You're here, and now Mr. Manx will come back, and I'll get to go to Christmas Land. You're here, and I'm finally going to get what's coming to me."
Images flickered rapidly through her mind, like playing cards shuffled by a magician. She was in the backyard again, Daltrey thumbing his lighter, getting no flame, so she took it from him, and blue fire leaped from the starter on her first try. She had paused to look at the picture on the side of the lighter, Popeye throwing a roundhouse, and a sound effect, she couldn't remember what. Then she visualized the warning on the side of the tank of sevoflurane, flammable. This was followed by a simple thought, not an image, but a decision.
"Take him with me. Kill this little turd."
The lighter, she thought, was in her right-hand pocket. She went to dig it out, but it was like reaching into Maggie's bottomless scrabble bag. It went on forever and forever and forever. The gas mask man stood at her feet, pointing the valve down at her, holding the tank in both arms. She could hear the tank whispering to her, a long, deadly command to be silent. Her fingers touched a slab of metal, closed around it. She yanked her hand out of her pocket and held the lighter up between her and the gas mask man, as if it were a cross to ward off a vampire.
"Don't make me," she gasped, and tasted another mouthful of poison gingerbread smoke.
"Don't make you what?" he said.
She flipped back the top of the lighter. The gas mask man heard it click, saw it for the first time, drew back a step.
"Hey," he said,
a note of warning in his voice. He took another step back, cradling the tank in his arms like a child.
"Don't! That isn't safe. Are you crazy?"
Vic thumbed the steel gear. It made a harsh scraping noise and spit a burst of white sparks, and for one miraculous moment it lit a ribbon of blue fire in the air. The flame unwound like a snake, the air burning, racing straight back at the tank. That faint white vapor spraying from the valve became a savage tongue of fire. The sevoflurane tank was, briefly, a flamethrower with a short range, spraying flame from side to side as the gas mask man reeled away from Vic. He stumbled backward three more steps, inadvertently saving her life in the process. In the flaring light, Vic could read what it said on the side of the lighter.
Kablooey!
It was as if the gas mask man were pointing a rocket launcher at his chest and triggered it at point-blank range. It exploded through the bottom, a cannonade of white-burning gas and shrapnel that lifted him off his feet and punched him back into the door. 300 liters of pressurized sevoflurane exploded all at once, turning the tank into a jumbo stick of TNT. Vic had no frame of reference for the sound it made, a great slam that felt like sewing needles stabbed into her eardrums. The gas mask man struck the iron door almost hard enough to tear it off its track. Vic saw him crash into it through a blast of what seemed like pure light, the air glowing with a gassy brilliance that made half the room disappear for an instant in a blinding white flash. She instinctively lifted her hands to protect her face and saw the fine gold hairs on her bare arms crinkling and shriveling from the heat. In the aftermath of the explosion, the world was changed. The room beat like a heart. Objects throbbed in time to the slamming of her pulse. The air was filled with a whirling golden smoke. When she had entered the room, she'd seen shadows leaping up from behind the furniture. Now they were casting flashes of brightness. Like the tank of gas, they seemed to be trying to swell and erupt. She felt a wet trickling on her cheek and thought it was tears, but when she touched her face, her fingertips came away red. Vic decided she ought to go. She got up and took a step, and the room slewed violently to the left, and she fell back down. She took a knee, just like they told you to do in Little League when someone was hurt. Burning scraps fell through the air. The room lurched to the right, and she lurched with it, onto her side. The brightness jumped up from the cot, the sink, flashed around the edges of the doorway. She had not known that every object in the world could contain a secret core of both darkness and light, needing only a violent shock to reveal one or the other. With each thump of her heart, the brightness brightened. She could not hear any sound except the ragged working of her lungs. She breathed deeply the perfume of burned gingerbread. The world was a bright bubble of light, doubling in size before her, swelling, straining, filling her vision, growing toward the inevitable pop. Christmasland, July 7th through 9th. The St. Nicholas Parkway. North of Columbus, Wayne closed his eyes for a moment, and when he opened them, the Christmas moon was sleeping in the night above, and either side of the highway was crowded with snowmen who turned their heads to watch the Wraith pass. The mountains rose before them, a monstrous wall of black stone at the edge of the world. The peaks were so high it looked as if the moon itself might get snagged among them. In a fold a little below the highest part of the highest mountain was a basket of lights. It shone in the darkness, visible from hundreds of miles away, a great glowing Christmas ornament. The sight of it was so exciting that Wayne could hardly remain in his seat. It was a cup of fire, a scoop of hot coals. It throbbed, and Wayne throbbed with it. Mr. Manx had one hand loose on the wheel. The road was so straight it could have been drawn with a ruler. The radio was on, and a boys' choir sang, "O Come All Ye Faithful." In Wayne's heart was an answer to their sacred invitation. "We are on our way. We are coming as fast as we can. Save a little Christmas for us." The snowmen stood in bunches, in families, and the breeze generated by the car snatched at their striped scarves. Snowmen fathers and snow girl mothers with their snow children and snow puppies. Top hats were in abundance, as were corncob pipes and carrot noses. They waved the crooked sticks of their arms, saluting Mr. Manx, Wayne, and Nosferatu as they went by. The black coals of their eyes gleamed, darker than the night, brighter than the stars. One snow dog had a bone in his mouth. One snow daddy held a mistletoe over his own head, while a snow mommy was frozen in the act of kissing his round white cheek. One snow child stood between decapitated parents, holding a hatchet. Wayne laughed and clapped. The living snowmen were the most delightful thing he had ever seen. What foolishness they got up to!
"What do you want to do first when we get there?" Mr. Manx asked from the gloom of the front seat. "When we get to Christmas Land."
The possibilities were so exciting it was hard to put them in order.
I'm going in the rock candy cave to see the abominable snowman. No, I'm going to ride in Santa's sleigh and save him from the cloud pirates.
There is a plan, Meg said. Rides first, games after.
What games?
The kids have a game called Scissors for the Drifter, which is the best time you've ever had. And then there is Stick the Blind. Son, you have not had fun until you have played Stick the Blind with someone really spry. Look, over on the right, there is a snow lion biting the head off a snow sheep.
Wayne turned his whole body to look out the right-hand window, but when he did, his grandmother was in his way. She was just as he had seen her last. She was brighter than anything in the back seat, as bright as snow in the moonlight. Her eyes were hidden behind silver half-dollars that flashed and gleamed. She had sent him half-dollars for his birthdays, but had never come herself, said she didn't like to fly.
Sky Falsa is that, said Linda McQueen. Same the not are fun and love. Reverse and go to trying, aren't you? Fight to trying, aren't you?
What do you mean the sky is false? Wayne asked. She pointed out the window, and Wayne craned his neck and looked up. A moment ago, the sky had been whirling with snow. Now, though, it was filled with static. A million billion fine flecks of black and gray and white buzzing furiously over the mountains. The nerve endings behind Wayne's eyeballs pulsed at the sight of it. It wasn't painfully bright. It was actually quite dim. But there was something about the furious motion of it that made it hard to watch. He flinched, shut his eyes, drew back. His grandmother faced him, eyes hidden behind those coins.
"If you wanted to play games with me, you should have come to visit me in Colorado," Wayne said. "We could have talked backward as much as you wanted. We didn't even talk forward when you were alive. I don't understand why you want to talk now."
"Who are you speaking with, Wayne?"
Manx asked.
"Nobody," Wayne said, and reached past Linda McQueen, opened the door, and shoved her out.
She weighed nothing. It was easy, like pushing away a bag of sticks. She flipped out of the car and hit the blacktop with a dry thud and shattered with a pretty musical smashing sound. And at that moment, Wayne jumped awake in Indiana and turned his head and looked out the rear window. A bottle had smashed in the road. Powdered glass cobwebbed the asphalt, shards tinkling and rolling. Manx had tossed a bottle of something. Wayne had seen him do this once or twice already. Charlie Manx didn't seem like the sort of guy inclined to recycle. When Wayne sat up, digging his knuckles into his eyes, the snowmen were gone. So were the sleeping moon and the mountains and the burning gem of Christmasland in the distance. He saw high green corn and a honky-tonk with a lurid neon sign depicting a 30-foot-tall blonde in a short skirt and cowboy boots. When the sign blinked, she kicked a foot, tipped her head back, closed her eyes, and kissed the darkness. Manx looked at him in the rearview mirror. Wayne felt flushed and muddle-headed from sleeping heavily, and perhaps for that reason it did not startle him to see how young and healthy Manx looked. His hat was off, and he was as bald as ever, but his scalp was smooth and pink, not white and splotchy. It had only yesterday looked like a globe, displaying a map of continents no one in his right mind would ever want to visit. The Isle of Sarcoma, North Liver Spot. Manx's eyes peered out from beneath sharp, arched eyebrows, the color of hoarfrost. Wayne did not think he had seen him blink once in the days they'd been together. For all he knew, the man had no eyelids. Yesterday morning he had looked like a walking corpse. Now he looked like he was in his mid-60s, vital and healthy. But there was a kind of avid stupidity in his eyes, the greedy stupidity of a bird looking at carrion in the road and wondering if it could get some tasty bits without being run down.
"Are you eating me?" Wayne asked. Manx laughed, a harsh caw. He even sounded like a crow. "If I have not taken a bite out of you yet, I am not likely to," Manx said. "I am not sure you would make much of a meal. There is not a lot of meat on you, and what is there is starting to smell a bit gamey. I am holding out for an order of those sweet potato fries."
Something was wrong with Wayne. He could feel it. He could not put his finger on what it was. He was achy and sore and feverish, but that might have just been from sleeping in the car, and this was something more. The best he could manage was a sense that his reactions to Manx were off. He had almost been surprised into laughter when Manx said the word gamey. He had never heard a word like that dropped into conversation before, and it struck him as hilarious. A normal person, though, wouldn't laugh at his kidnapper's choice of words.